Friday means Week in Review, and we begin today with big news from Governor Charlie Baker. Just this afternoon, Baker announced he's slowing our state's reopening process amid an uptick in coronavirus cases, indefinitely postponing Step 2 of Phase 3.
5 weeks ago, we laid out new economic sectors that could open in Phase 3. This uptick in cases and reports of people not adhering to the guidance we have put forth here in Massachusetts means we cannot move forward at this time or any time soon in the near future.
For more on the changes coming down from the governor's office, let's turn to Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, hello.
Hey, Jamie.
So, step two, phase three, postponed indefinitely. What does that mean?
Well, first of all, it's the first sign we've officially seen from Governor Baker that things are not going 100% to plan. Logistically, what does it mean? It means that activities that have a greater chance of contact, like the governor lists laser tag, roller skating, trampolines, obstacle courses, things like that on their website. Also means indoor performance venues, theaters, and that sort of thing would not be allowed to open for the near future.
Theaters, but movie theaters are already
I was just going to say, yeah, we remember movie theaters opened at the beginning of July. So that's not kind of included in that. But we do know the indoor limit is still at 25 people. So,
and he also reduced the outdoor gathering size from 100 to 50. Do you consider this a rollback then of where we were?
It does seem like both a pause and a slight rollback. He's not exactly saying certain sectors of industry need to close that have been allowed to open. But as you said, he's limiting the gathering size outdoors to 50 people. And that now applies to both public and private property. He also seemed to have a real frustration with bars that he said were masquerading as restaurants. Basically, if you put pretzels or chips or something out for folks who are getting drinks, that shouldn't count. And they're really going to focus on making sure places that are serving alcohol are also serving food that's prepared on site. And all of these are supposed to kick in on Tuesday, the 11th.
I see. Just how bad are the numbers right now?
So it feels as if this is an early uptick. We had heard rumblings over the last week or so from medical experts that numbers were sort of trending upwards. Everybody likes to look at that 7-day average as opposed to one day where you might have kind of a statistical anomaly. For the entire month of July, pretty much the percent of positive test rates was below 2%. For the last week or so, we've seen that creep at or above 2%. And I think that's one of the metrics that really has folks in the governor's office worried.
What is the governor's office and what did he announce today? What are they doing in terms of trying to stem that tide beyond pausing?
Yeah, the other side of his announcement today was he's creating a task force to focus on enforcement. Here's a little bit about what he had to say about that.
Today, I'm authorizing all state and local police officers to enforce these orders, and event hosts who violate these orders will be subject to fines.
So that's something, Jamie, that Governor Baker has resisted throughout this. He really wanted to leave enforcement up to local control. He said that communities have been frustrated by the fact that they'll call authorities and authorities basically have nothing to do. So he's now authorizing fines. And it'll be interesting to see. He said they're going to focus on hard hit areas. Mm-hmm. So that immediately brings to mind the question of equity. Will these rules be enforced equally across all communities? We'll have to see how it shakes out. But this is definitely a change in tactics from Governor Baker.
Chris, I have to say, in watching the governor in the last couple of days and weeks, he seemed to be saying over and over again, don't make me turn this car around. And today he sounded even more exacerbated. And I want to play just another clip here. This is where he described how he's been socially distancing since March.
Outside of the people that I work with on a socially distanced basis, we spent time with about 10 people, period, since March. 10. People need to understand that big groups, especially if people don't distance and don't wear face coverings, create, in many cases, spread.
Chris, what did you make of this moment? He seems to sort of be reflecting how so many of us are feeling right now.
Yeah, I was really struck by that moment too, Jamie. I felt like for those of us who have taken this seriously and done the things that Governor Baker has asked folks to do, quarantined as much as possible, limit recreational activities, make sure you're not gathering in large groups and distancing at all whenever possible. There's been, a portion of the population that seems to have gone back to living life as normal. We've seen reports of these kind of large scale parties happening in different places across the state. And I think for folks who are making the sacrifices and doing the things that the governor's asking them to do, it can be incredibly frustrating and create a real sense of anger and confusion for when you also see folks who are not doing that. And then you see numbers trending upwards in terms of cases.
Finally, Chris, we mentioned that, you know, we're under a number of orders here. There's the travel order that's in place since Monday. What does all of this mean going forward for the people of Massachusetts?
Yeah, I think it means a couple of things. I think, number one, it means that the threat of a second wave is real, and it's something that Governor Baker and his task force is taking very seriously. I also think it's a reminder of how much pain this causes, both in the direct result of, obviously, cases and hospitalizations and deaths. These are real people, obviously, not right. just numbers on a page. But also, secondarily, economically, we've seen, the survey that came out this week, almost a third of people think they might not be able to pay their rent. We've mm-hmm. seen businesses closing and layoffs across the board. So I think there's a real concern and a real sense of pain being felt by a lot of folks in the state. And it's troubling to see things going in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Radio Boston's Chris Siderick, thanks. And we'll talk to you a little later in the show.
All right. Thanks, Jamie.
So let's pick it up right there with our Week in Review panelists. Joining us on the line is Seti Warren, the executive director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and former mayor of Newton. Seti, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you and great to be back.
Also with us is Charlie Chippio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and principal of Chippio Strategies. Charlie, welcome to you.
Good to be here.
And listeners, pull up a chair. How are you reacting to the governor's rollback here and the uptick in cases? Is this the right move or another crippling blow to our economy? Call us. Share your thoughts. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Okay, so I want to start there with that. Seti Warren, Baker announcing these rollbacks. Right decision?
Look, I think the governor did make the right decision. You know, early on when this crisis started unfolding, I started engaging with a group called the COVID-19 Action Coalition. They're physician-led. At the end of the day, this is about following the data and the science. Unlike some other states and other governors, I believe that this governor has been doing that from early on. That being said, you know, we've got to really watch this over the course of the next several weeks and months. To continue to look at whether this uptick continues and put other measures in place. The one thing I would say about the governor's announcement today that I also think we have to keep an eye on is the enforcement element. You know, there are sets of data that shows people of color over-policed in different communities. And I think we need to keep an eye on the numbers and the data as the enforcement element to this goes into play.
Charlie Chippio, so how do we balance those two things? The need, perhaps in certain communities where numbers might be spiking, with also making sure that we're not over-policing certain communities?
Yeah, and it's a very difficult balance because of the fact that many of those communities where the numbers are spiking are communities where there are higher percentages of people of color. So it is really for law enforcement, not just for law enforcement, but for this enforcement group that Governor Baker announced today. I think this is going to be the challenge that they have to face because, you know, I would just reinforce what Seti just said. Look, I support what Governor Baker did today. What I don't know, and I think only probably a few experts really fully understand, is how much we know about exactly the nature of this sort of uptick. Is it more generalized? Is it due to specific things that we can point to? You know, if it is more generalized, which I suspect it may be, ultimately, I wonder if we won't need to do more than this to get it under control. But I certainly support these steps today.
Well, that's sort of the issue there, right, Seti? It's the governor has been saying over and over again, there are these clusters, there's a few groups of bad behavior, and he cites Falmouth and a couple other places, Chatham, and these big parties, and this hotel in Gardner. But could it be a little bit a mixture of both things, bad behavior and also the fact that we're open?
Yeah, it could be. It could be a combination of both. And one other thing to mention with communities of color, you know, there are a number of reasons why the numbers are higher. There's a lot of Black and Brown people in industries and jobs that are on the front lines, so their exposure is higher, and on. So I do think that needs to be realized. But yeah, there could be a combination of both. Yeah, there could be a combination of both. I think the governor voicing his frustration over those parties is important, and vocalizing that. But we also have to, you know, come to terms with the data and the science and the fact that, this virus is something that we can't actually control. What we can do is moderate our behavior and listen to physicians and scientists.
1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. What do you make of this? Let's go to Karen calling from Newton. Karen, you're next on Radio Boston.
I own a restaurant in Newton, and I really experienced the duality of this, also having a mother-in-law that is in a nursing home. So I just want to add that I think we need clarity and great public messaging around the high-risk behaviors, which clearly are the big gathering events, the super-spreading activity, and also give people a perspective on the low-risk events. I was on a phone call with Dr. Paul Currier from MGH recently, and he indicated that if restaurants are following all the protocols that we know to do, the distancing, mask, cleaning, that dining in, you know, with another person or with your family in a restaurant is considered, by his estimate, and he saw the first COVID patient here, as a low-risk activity. So I don't want to miss also the importance of what's happening to the economy. We are about to go off a cliff in terms of our industry, and local independent restaurants are the biggest multiplier of economic dollars that we have.
Karen, is your restaurant at risk?
I think every restaurant's at risk. I'm grateful that we have sales that are continuing to trend slowly up, and because of the space we have enough space that people are comfortable dining inside. But I am working with the restaurant owners group, and I can tell you the fall is coming, and without another PPP, you will see a lot of restaurant owners having to make some very difficult decisions. So, yes, it's a deeply concerning time, and I think if we can craft the right message, so we talk about low-risk behaviors versus high-risk,
yep,
and
okay,
knowing
Karen,
that we have to live with this for a while. So thank you.
We got it. Thanks for the call there. Seti Warren, how about that? This idea that not only do we need to get the messaging right, but we also have to make sure we balance the economic needs of everyone out there.
Yeah, Karen makes a great point. One of my former constituents on the business side. Look, as a former mayor, someone that's been in government, different parts of government, the one piece to this that I think is important is not to create a false choice. Karen's right that we should follow the science, make sure people know what the low-risk behaviors are. At the same time, there's a responsibility for government to intervene to ensure that businesses can stay afloat through this terrible time, and that individuals can stay afloat. I don't think we should be in a position where we choose public safety over economic conditions. So I also would say there are government interventions at varying levels that need to happen, and we shouldn't just create a false choice.
Charlie Chippio, so in the event of a second surge, are we ready financially?
Oh, God, financially? No, certainly not. I mean, look, I did a piece with Greg Sullivan, a policy brief a while back, talking about the unemployment situation for Pioneer Institute. And, you know, we were calling for federal block grants to pay for these additional costs that state government is going to face. And I'm sure local governments will face as well. And, you know, Pioneer is not really in the business of calling for those kind of things. I mean, look, the kind of costs that state governments and local governments are having to face, and the fact that unlike the federal government, they can't just run deficits. You know, so I think that we are not at all in the financial condition that we need to be to deal with this. And I would, for just as a guy who used to work for Paul Tsongas back in the day, and named it, few will remember, just I can't help but point out
former
the fact
senator
that over the last we have that and over the last few years, as we've had, you know, what is at least at the macro level, a very good economy, rather than paying down the debt to help us be able to deal with an event like this, it only skyrocketed. And that is very problematic at these kind of times.
I want to go back to the phones here. Rick is calling from Orleans. Rick, welcome to Radio Boston. Hello, Rick, you there?
Yes.
Rick, I think we lost you there, Rick. All right, let's try another caller here. Let's go to Christine is calling from Somerville. Christine, you're next on Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to say I just agree with what I've heard about, you know, communities of color focusing on education rather than enforcement there. And but I just want to say that from the beginning, I have really valued the governor's approach, but I've also felt like the priorities are way off. We've prioritized opening restaurants and bars. We can't now predict, we can't confirm whether our children can go back to school safely. If kids being in school is a major economic driver, we can't guarantee the safety. We're asking teachers to put their lives on the line so bars and restaurants can open. So I understand the economic impact, but we can't get our kids back to school. And if we can't get our kids back to school, we can't get the economy back together. So the priorities have been off from the beginning. And I think there needs to be a major shift towards how do we get children back in school so their parents can go back to work.
Thank you, Christine, for that call. And I just want to note that bars are not allowed to open yet under the rules, the governor's orders. But so Christine brings up, of course, schools, which is a big part of this conversation. And I want to play a clip here from the governor this afternoon, because in some ways it's interesting that he's rolling back, but at the same time pushing to open in-person schooling. Let's listen.
If you think about kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade, the grades that generally speaking, most of the tests and the studies that have been done make pretty clear are those least likely to be infected in the first place. Trying to teach those kids how to read remotely, I mean, that's not how you teach kids how to read.
So, Seti Warren, how about that?
Well, look, I think from around the country, we're seeing students that went back into the classroom during the summer are displaying some higher transmission and getting sick. And so there's still a lot of unknowns in around the science of young people. I'm not disagreeing with what the governor said, but there's still a lot of unknowns around that. You know, I'm a parent of a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old, one in middle school, one in elementary. And my district has not made a decision here in Newton what direction to go, but it is a really frightening prospect to think about the choice that we're gonna have to make, and a lot of parents are gonna have to make, and whether they send their kids back in if that district opens up or not. Lastly, I think it was the last caller that brought up disparities. She's right that really a number of months ago, you know, there should have been a real effort to figure out what the options might be based on the science. You know, if you go all offline, like some districts are doing, you're going to see huge disparities of folks in underserved communities within that district. If you do a hybrid, you're going to see some disparities. So none of that has been, you know, we haven't concentrated on that in a serious way. And I think
we also have disparities
at a higher level,
even under the best of circumstances, right?
Yeah.
COVID-19 has exposed a lot of those disparities that existed. So you're right.
Go ahead, Charlie.
Yeah, no, that is certainly true. If I could also hark back to Christine's call, I guess the thing I would disagree with her on is I don't see this as a trade-off of, you know, restaurants for schools. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't really see that schools are going to be able to open safely, at least not right away. And I don't think that the fact that we've opened restaurants is the reason why. I think that that is just you know, that is just the reality of this virus and what we're facing right now. And there is, you know, there's no good way out of this. There's no doubt that not opening schools in person is going to affect everybody negatively, but is going to disproportionately impact those who are poor and, you know, have less opportunities in the first place. You know, but, you know, it just seems to me not realistic to be able to do that right away. And I would also add that while I think for the very early grades, teaching remotely is not the most effective thing to do, I would say that when it comes to remote education, there are places that do it well, not necessarily, as the governor said, to teach people to read, but there are places that have done it pretty well. And Massachusetts is not one of those places. We have not done well in terms of the switch to remote education when you compare it to what some other places have done.
Charlie, just to push back a little bit on that idea of a trade-off, we heard from Dr. Ashish Jha from Harvard, and he's one of those folks who's concerned about our reopening in schools. And so I want to play a little bit of a tape from him here.
If we said, okay, forget schools, we don't really care if kids are all online, then you probably have a bit more running room. You can let the infections rate get higher. You won't fill up your hospitals too much. And, you know, I mean, people will get sick and some people will die, but you can tolerate a certain level of infection. If you actually care about schools, then you probably need to tolerate a much, much lower level of indoor gatherings. And that includes restaurants, bars, gyms.
Is that the true trade-off there?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, to a degree, I think it's absolutely right. I think that where we're going to need to go with this, if we have to take further steps, which I suspect that we will, is definitely going to be greater limitations on indoor gatherings. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think that it's appropriate to say that we have been in any way, you know, profligate with allowing stuff to open up like crazy, you know, to the detriment of other things like getting students back to school. Look, we're figuring this out as we go. And thankfully we know a whole lot more than we did in March, but we don't have all the answers yet. And so the best thing that we can do is to be guided by the science and to act accordingly.
I want to go to a break in just a moment here, but first I want to see if we can get Rick from Orleans back on here. Rick, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. I'm in several of the high-risk groups. My family and I live year-round in Orleans. I'm in a wheelchair. I'm about to hit 70, and I'm coming off round of chemotherapy. And my wife and I are just really very concerned at the normal behavior that we see from so many visitors to the Cape and probably a good number of regular Cape residents or year-rounders. We see so many people not wearing masks. We see young people clustering in groups, having parties on the beach. We see restaurant outdoor patios where tables are certainly not 6 feet apart. And it's an awful feeling to realize that every time you put your mask and gloves on, if you have to go outside to buy food or go to the drugstore or any other life errand, you're putting your life at risk. Yeah. Because people are simply not taking things seriously.
Rick, I just do want to ask you how you're doing. I hope you're doing okay.
I'm doing well, thank you. And I support the governor. I think he's doing the right thing. Unfortunately, I believe we're going to have to make examples out of some people because they're simply not taking it seriously.
Well, it's I can hear the frustration in your voice there. So thanks for sharing that with us. I want to turn to a caller here. We have Betsy from Brewster. Betsy, you're on Radio Boston.
Hi, I'm really disgusted by the scoff laws, and I think that a fine is not going to make a difference. So
it's
what
a $300
I would suggest
fine.
Is what?
$300 fine?
Yeah, I don't think it'll make a difference. I think people will just ignore it. What I think we should do is collect names and social security numbers and health care information, and then when people show up at the hospital, say, "Oh, sorry, you don't qualify anymore for getting any health care from this hospital."
Betsy, thanks for the call. Seti Warren, you know, we are at a place where a lot of information is being collected by the government right now. We've got this travel order in place where you have to register when you come into the state. How about that idea that Betsy puts on the table?
Well, I'm not sure of the ethical or legal possibilities of Betsy's proposal. But I think I hear her frustration around this. And I think one of the challenges I think that we have around this is it really has been politicized nationally. I started off at the top talking about the data and the science, and how within the media ecosystem, there's just a lot of mixed messages depending on what you watch and what you consume. And I think that's a really serious challenge right now when people are making decisions around their own behavior. I think that sort of has clouded the focus on science and medicine. And it's a real challenge moving forward.
Well, Charlie, part of it is so much of the science and what we know is unknown, if that makes sense.
Right. That's right. I mean, look, I think we all remember not very long ago, March, April, we were being told, well, don't wear masks. It's not going to make any difference. And, you know, now we know a lot more, and masks seems to be the single most important thing we can do to protect ourselves and to protect others to an even greater degree. So, you know, that's very true. I think you take that and you add it to just the human, you know, just just being tired of this, you know, it's just hard to maintain it, but you know, we're hopefully not that far from a vaccine, and we just have to keep it up for a little bit longer.
Well, of course, in the meantime, there's also universities, which we haven't even touched on, talking about coming back, bringing in-person students back to Boston. Is that a concern for you, Seti Warren? You were the mayor of Newton, and Boston College is right on its border there. They're planning on bringing some students back to campus. Does that concern you?
Yeah, well, I'd be very, very concerned. You know, we not only have Boston College, but we have two other colleges within Newton. These are the types of things we've got to monitor. We've got to look at the numbers. We've got to look at the data. And, you know, government officials need to engage with those college presidents and leadership about whether or not they should move forward. Every mayor should be thinking about this. Every town should be thinking about this, board of select persons and such. This is one of those pieces around the reopening that where government has to play a role and can't sort of play a laissez-faire attitude towards it.
We've got Sari calling from Haverhill. Sari, you're next on Radio Boston.
So I just want to speak to somebody that had mentioned that Massachusetts didn't do real well in the turnaround, or that teachers weren't doing, you know, students weren't learning enough. I can tell you that most of the teachers that I know, not only did we end up working more hours than we've ever worked in a day, but I myself would be on my computer with students at night, and I have special education, so I would do one-to-one with some of my students. But I also had parents that didn't get their students up at 10:45 or 11 o'clock in the morning and would let them stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning. Whether you're mandated to sign into school or not, your teachers were all working. We were all there with lessons to be taught. So, you know, I have to say that maybe we did do a really good job, and maybe there were just some people that didn't acclimate to getting their children up, or didn't want parents fighting with children. But, you know, 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, kids should be up and online and ready to learn.
Sari, there's no question that it has been a challenge for everyone involved. Charlie?
Yeah, no, it's just I'm the one who said that. And I'm sorry, Sarah, I want to be clear about that. My issue with what Massachusetts has done is the lack of readiness on the part of districts and on the part of the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. I'm certainly not blaming the fact that we were not good at remote education on the teachers. I don't think it had anything to do with the teachers. I think it simply had to do with the lack of preparedness and the lack of what needed to be done to make it's never going to be a seamless transition in a situation like this, but the most seamless transition possible. This was an administrative issue and not a teacher issue at all.
Jen is calling from Tingsboro. Jen, you're next on Radio Boston.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
So I am a parent of two small children with Down syndrome in Tingsboro, and I'm also a high school English teacher in a neighboring and I've been on my school's reopening task force with developing the three plans that Jesse wanted.
Unfortunately, we're losing you here. Your line is breaking up. But let's try Jeremy, who's calling from Clinton. Jeremy, you're on Radio Boston.
Hi. Yeah. As your previous caller had said, I as well am a teacher in Massachusetts, and we found like most of the teachers found it incredibly hard when the commissioner had came out and said that the students would be passed on and changed up how the grading would work. And it made it extremely harder for the teachers. And I don't think a lot of parents know that. And so the questions of how hard it was for the teachers to develop a good program was kind of hampered by giving away easy grades for that.
Great. Thanks for the call there, Jeremy. Seti Warren, before we move on to another topic here, I just want to ask you, is there any good way to approach this right now? It just seems like every option is difficult, challenging, and leaves everyone dissatisfied.
Well, look, you know, I sat on my school committee as the mayor, and when we were not dealing with COVID-19, you know, a district with diverse backgrounds, races, challenges as far as special education, it was already complicated. This makes it even worse. I think that Charlie made some very good points. One of the challenges that we have is that every district is on their own, and every district is making their own administrative decisions. One of the town's superintendents and administrators had said, I need to understand the science behind this better, and I need guidance and advice so I can make the right decisions. And I think that's exactly right. I think that there's a role for state government in engaging with districts on the ground, giving them the best science and understanding and data, and coming up with the best guidance on how to implement either offline, which I think is where we may be heading, and address the disparities within the district, whether it's special education, underserved kids. There really needs to be, a connection with state and local government and real guidance so that districts can make the right decisions.
I do want to shift gears here in the few minutes that we have left and talk a little bit about a ruling that came down right at the end of our show last Friday, with implications reverberating in Boston this week. The decision from a panel of federal judges to throw out the death penalty sentence for Jahar Tsarnaev, citing significant issues with juror impartiality in the case, the guilty verdict, and his life without parole sentence stands. It's now up to the Justice Department as to how to proceed, pursue the death penalty further with another sentencing trial, or allow the life sentence to hold. Seti, Charlie, what are your reactions to this decision?
Well, I'll start. I mean, I'm speaking as a lawyer who's never practiced law a day in my life. It just seems to me, and I am admittedly biased because I'm not a fan of the death penalty, but it just seems to me that when you have a situation where Jahar Tsarnaev will spend the rest of his life in jail, that to put the system and more importantly, the victims and their families and everything through all this again, and not to mention all the countless appeals and everything that you would have just in pursuit of a death sentence as opposed to life imprisonment. I'm sure you know this is obviously a hot button issue, and there are many who will disagree with me, but I just don't see that as worth it.
Well, one of the folks who might disagree with you on that is Liz Norden. Her sons, Paul and JP, each lost a leg in the bombing, and she was a vocal proponent of the death penalty for Tsarnaev. We spoke with her at the end of last week. Here's what she said.
You know, it's been 7 years, and we live it every day, but somewhat of normalcy has set in, and you can kind of move on and move forward, and then they have to go through it all over again. Really just sucks. So I will go. I went every day, almost every day, for the first trial and sat through it all, and I will do it again. Wherever it may be.
Seti Warren, this idea that for so many of us, life, of course, goes on, it changes, we're in a pandemic now, and for the victims and their families, as Charlie was describing too, there's always that pain and potentially more pain to revisit the horrific scenes of that day again in court.
Yes, you know, I was mayor during the awful terrorist attack. The Boston Marathon goes right through Newton, right by City Hall. And I remember that day vividly when the race was stopped and runners had to go into City Hall. There was panic. There was trauma, people trying to get in touch with their loved ones at the end of the race. They couldn't get in touch with them. And, you know, then you remember the horrific scenes and the victims, the people that died, and the people that were in and around that scene. It was so dramatic and so traumatic. you know, when I think about this, the question is, you know, what is right for those families and people who suffered great loss? What's right for the community that suffered the trauma, Boston and our state? When you think about this, that's how I think about it. I have grave reservations around that. I know there's a split within some of the families. Some of the families don't want to see another trial. Some of the families do. But I think we have to ask ourselves that question. Is that, will that yield justice by going through another trial? And I have serious reservations about it as a resident. I would never want to speak for the families, but certainly as a resident of our state, I have serious reservations about it. And I admittedly, like Charlie, do have pretty serious problems with the death penalty. But aside whether you believe in it or not, I think that is a central question to this.
Well, the family of 8-year-old Martin Richard, who was killed on the finish line, they, of course, have declined requests to speak this week to news outlets, instead referring folks to their 2015 essay in the Boston Globe, where they write in part, "The continued pursuit of the death penalty could bring years of appeals and prolong reliving the most painful day of our lives. We hope our two remaining children do not have to grow up with the lingering, painful reminder of what the defendant took from them, which years of appeals would undoubtedly bring." And earlier this week, we spoke with WBUR reporter emeritus David Boeri, and he said exactly as you described it, Seti, no punishment will truly bring justice.
What is justice in the end? You know, seems to me that justice is Martin Richards coming to life and people being restored with legs and arms. We don't have justice in that sort, and we're not going to get it.
We're not going to get that justice from Martin Richard, as David Boeri says. So how do we get any sense of justice, Charlie Chipio?
Well, that's, you know, that is the question here. And I would wholeheartedly agree with Seti that really this has to be viewed through the lens of the people that's affected the most. And when I see those families as split as they are, I think the closest thing we can come to justice is to not pursue this further. But again, you know, I'm certainly not the last word on that. This is, you know, there's such, you know, correctly, there's such strong feelings on this in both ways. And, you know, sometimes justice is very imperfect, and I'm afraid that that's largely what the case is here.
There's also, Seti Warren, an argument that death, as difficult as the whole process is final, that Tsarnaev is 27 now, and maybe there's a concern that someday over the next 70 or so years of his life, if he served a life sentence, something could change, laws could change, presidents change, but that there's a finality in that ultimate penalty that maybe could bring closure to some families.
Well, I trust Judge Gertner on this one, and I trust her legal background and legal mind in saying that this man will never get out. And she is pretty adamant about that in her public comments. And I think that that's true. And I think that, unfortunately, the horrific, heinous act that he did, what Charlie said, you know, justice isn't perfect here. But for some, knowing that this man will never see the light of day and will have to live with this every day, is a partial piece of justice that's important.
Well, Seti Warren is the executive director of the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Kennedy School and former mayor of Newton. Seti, thank you for joining us today for This Week in Review.
Very much appreciate being with you. Thank you.
And Charlie Chipio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and principal of Chipio Strategies, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you, Jamie.
It's Friday, and believe it or not, we've actually got a couple of Boston sports teams in action tonight. So let's check the score with Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, didn't we just talk to you?
Yeah, you can't get rid of me. Sorry, Jamie. Here I am.
On sports, you're the expert. Where do you want to start?
Ooh, dealer's choice. I like this. All right. I'm going to start with the Celtics because they've got actually a kind of a big game tonight. It's what we call in the sports world a measuring stick game. It basically they're playing the Toronto Raptors, who are the two seed in the East. The Celtics right now are currently the three seed. It's a good chance to play a good team and figure out how good you are. The Celtics have been kind of up and down. We're halfway through these seeding games before the basketball playoffs are going to start. They're 2-2. They had a big win on Wednesday night against the Nets. They put up 149 points. That was nice to see because they had looked a little lackadaisical kind of in their first few games. And so going up against Toronto tonight, Toronto's the defending champion. They're a hungry team. They lost Kawhi Leonard in the offseason, who's potentially arguably the best player in the league. As I said, they're the two seed. So it's a good chance to see kind of where this team stacks up. I'm hoping to see the Celtics come out hungry and aggressive tonight. We'll see what happens.
Chris, measuring sticks, seeding games, it's French to me. So what does that actually mean?
Basically, this is going to tell you where you're going to line up in the playoffs. And if you're the number one team, that means you are the best team in the regular season. You're going to have the easiest path to get to the finals. So the Celtics don't want to drop too far down that. We really want to see them hold on to the three seed here. It'll just mean they have easier matchups getting to the finals, basically.
Are they any good?
They are. The question is, are they going to show
you
up?
Don't sound I know, convinced, Chris.
So they have a lot of talent, right? The question is, do they show up every night and do they play a full game? When the league paused back in mid-March, they looked like they were really hitting their stride. It was kind of a tough hit for them. Both the Celtics and the Bruins really looked like they were true title contenders. Jason Tatum was one of the top 10 players in the league, and they were giving consistent effort on the defensive end night in and night out. We haven't quite seen that so far in these seeding games in the bubble down in Orlando, but we know they have the talent to do it. So really it's just going to be a matter of, can they put it all together? Are they going to put in the effort consistently? And are they going to be able to play as a team? Basketball, I think more than any other sport, chemistry matters. You have to be able to trust your guys. You have to know where they're going to be, anticipate what they're going to do in certain situations and react. And so really they're shaking off the rust. They've been off for months here. And so you can tell that it's taking them a little while to kind of hit that stride. Really,
are there enough games left for them to shake all that rust off?
Hopefully. I don't know. We'll see. I do think tonight will go a long way in telling us, can they step up when they are facing a serious challenge? Tonight really could be a statement game for them. I'm excited.
So there's also the Red Sox tonight, 7:30? And then we've got the Bruins this weekend. I don't really understand how there's hockey in August, but what are you watching
playing on
for?
Sunday. I love this. The Bruins game is on Sunday at a time still to be determined. We don't know when that game is going to be on Sunday yet.
What does it depend on?
Who knows? The league has to tell us when they're going to schedule it. We don't really know why they haven't announced that yet. The Red Sox, you mentioned, rough start. They've dropped four. They're 4-8 right now into a 60-game season. It looks like it's going to be a rough year. We've talked about baseball's allowing more teams to make the playoffs this year because it's such a weird season. So they may even squeak into the playoffs, but I'm not too excited about what they're putting on the field. The Bruins I'm much more interested in because I do think they are potentially the real deal, although they also have kind of gotten off to a sluggish start in the restart here.
So I'm wondering, thinking about sports right now, Chris, there's no fans in the stands. What is the viewing experience like?
Yeah, it's weird. I am so glad to have them back for sure. And I think it's interesting because sports for a long time, we all just kind of considered an escape from the world. You would sit down, watch a game and not really think about what's going on in the real world. It's not really the case anymore, right? As you mentioned, you've got these screens with kind of virtual fans for basketball.
Fake crowd noise?
Yeah, that's right. And some broadcasts are handling it better than others, I'll say. I'm not a fan of the fake crowd noise. I guess you got to have something, but it just feels like the energy isn't quite there. You also have a lot of the leagues, the NBA is probably taking the lead on the social justice causes, using the platform to draw attention to our current moment. I don't know if you've caught any footage of these games, but players have been allowed to put their choice of, I think there were 29 options of possible slogans on the back of their jersey, things like equality, freedom, Black Lives Matter, instead of their
some folks
that's normally
kneeling,
where your last
some
name
have been standing.
Yeah, a lot of teams, pretty much most of the league in terms of the NBA has been kneeling during the anthem, coaches as well. So with all of that kind of aside, I have to say the normalcy of it really is nice. It's great to have that kind of routine coming back to sports, having something to root for. The title, if any of the Boston teams win a title, yeah, you could say it's not really a title in
kind
of
the way
we think
about it.
These are funky.
Next to it,
yeah,
right?
these are totally funky tournaments. It's kind of like a one-off, basically. But it's still something to root for. And just, man, I can't tell you how great it is to have that ritual back. Now,
Chris, you know this. I am admittedly, famously not a sports person. but
you don't say.
I know that sports is a big deal for the city and for fans like you. Are you at least happy that there is some semblance of a season in all of these sports?
I can't tell you how big the smile on my face was when I got to turn on the Celtics last weekend and realized that I was going to get to enjoy a game that's leading up to a tournament where there are playoff stakes. You know, I'm not minimizing what we're dealing with. This is an incredibly tough moment for so many people for so many reasons. But I think sports has this element of togetherness, right? We've been so isolated over the last few months, but I watch a game, it gives me an excuse to text my dad or talk to one of my buddies. And it brings us together in a way that I think so much of the news is not able to do right now.
Yeah, you're not texting them about coronavirus or something.
Yeah. For a couple of hours, you're thinking about something else. Like I was yelling at Gordon Hayward through my TV on Sunday.
No,
it was so nice to complain about something that doesn't actually matter. Like when a ref makes a bad call or something, you get all upset and then you realize, oh, actually, no.
It whatever. Matters to you. That matters.
It matters in the moment. But, you know, I realize in the terms of the grand scheme of things, these are inconsequential things. But it's nice to get upset about something and know that it's something that's trivial.
Chris, in our last 30 seconds here, not to be a Debbie Downer, but you know, we are in the middle of this pandemic. We do have cases at least upticking a little bit here in Massachusetts. Are you worried it'll all go away again?
I mean, it's one of those things. If it needs to go away, it needs to go away. And folks have raised ethical questions about the amount of testing resources that are being put into bringing these leagues back. I think football is probably doomed. I don't think there's any chance we get through a full or even a half football season. We'll see. Baseball seems pretty committed to limping through and getting something. But I'm really hopeful. Celtics and Bruins, man, deep runs in the playoffs. Give us something to believe in, please.
Chris, your enthusiasm and excitement always gets me through. Radio Boston's Chris Siderick, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.